From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
A new approach to rooting out the Taliban. I'm Cherry Glazer, sitting in for Warren Olney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. It's being called a major coup in the war against the Taliban. The Taliban's top military leader, Mullah Abdul Ghani Baradar, has reportedly been captured in a joint operation by American and Pakistani forces. Can Mullah Baradar shed light on how the Taliban operates? Will he lead the U.S. to other top Taliban leaders? And what impact might this have on the new offensive the U.S. has launched in Afghanistan? Later on Reporter's Notebook, the fine art of judging figure skating. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
I'm Cherry Glazer, sitting in for Warren Olney, back with To the Point from PRI. The U.S. launched a major new offensive in Afghanistan this weekend, but just 4 days in, questions are already cropping up about the challenges troops face and their odds of long-term success. The mission depends heavily on cooperation from both Afghan forces and the Afghan government. But are they up to the job? On Reporter's Notebook, the fine art of figure skating judging. First, this news update. A new nuclear power plant has not been built in the U.S. since Ronald Reagan was in office. But it looks like that's about to change. President Obama today announced more than $8 billion in federal loan guarantees for building two new nuclear reactors in Georgia. Mr. Obama says the reactors will help meet the need for more clean energy while also generating new jobs.
On an issue that affects our economy, our security, and the future of our planet, we can't keep on being mired in the same old stale debates between the left and the right, between environmentalists and entrepreneurs. See, our competitors are racing to create jobs and command growing energy industries. And nuclear energy is no exception.
That was President Obama speaking earlier today in Maryland. Here to give us more insight on the issue is Ben Geeman. He writes the Environment and Energy blog for the congressional newspaper The Hill. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on.
Now, Mr. Obama portrayed these new reactors as a kind of twofer, good for the economy, helping to reduce carbon emissions. Do you think he's trying to win support from as broad an array as he can from both business groups and groups concerned about climate change?
I think that's absolutely right. Both, you know, what you're saying and the snippet of the president's comments that you mentioned really encapsulate where the White House is at right now on energy and climate change policy. And what they're really seeking to do is court Republicans and industry to support a sort of much broader climate and climate change and energy package. And what they've said repeatedly is that a big part of that is going to be a large expansion of support for domestic nuclear power. Not only do we have these first guarantees that they're rolling out, you know, this $8.3 billion for Southern Company to build these new reactors, but the White House budget request also seeks a total of I believe it's $54 billion worth of loan guarantees for the nuclear industry.
How is all this going down with environmentalists? In the past, they've expressed concern that we don't know how to safely dispose of nuclear waste.
That's right. You know, there is a fair amount of concern and criticism within the environmental community, and you have seen some groups criticizing the president's plan. But, you know, at the same time, I think what's been clear for some months now is that if there is a way forward on Capitol Hill for a compromise climate change and energy bill, you know, it's been very clear that part of that agreement would be an increase in support for new nuclear power plants, as well as perhaps some expanded offshore drilling. So I think, you know, I don't think you're going to see are the large environmental organizations that are pushing for some type of limits on greenhouse gas emissions, such as the Natural Resources Defense Council and the Sierra Club and the National Wildlife Federation and so forth. This is not going to be a deal breaker for them. You're not going to see them walk away from this effort to have some type of final climate change and energy bill on Capitol Hill. You've got a process going on right now where Senators John Kerry and Lindsey Graham and Joe Lieberman are trying to cobble together some type of compromise package, and nuclear energy would be a big part of it.
Now, this comes at a time when overall climate change legislation has stalled in Congress. Do you think that the president might sort of try a barter here, saying to the Republicans or perhaps the business community, hey, you know, we're trying to move ahead on nuclear. Can you give a little bit over here instead?
Oh, I think that's certainly what the president is doing. You know, this is if you look at his State of the Union address, it was very, very heavy on those themes. And you know, again, the snippet that you just played had the same idea, which is that he's saying we need to strike some type of larger compromise here between the right and the left. And in a nutshell, he's calling on you know, environmentalists to you know, accept some degree of, you know, increased fossil energy development as well as increased nuclear energy development. But in return, he's saying to Republicans, and you know, he said this when he's been appearing before Republicans recently, look, you know, why don't you guys come toward us a little bit on this issue of accepting some type of limits on greenhouse gas emissions. But despite that outreach, I think it's going to still be a very tough climb in the Senate to move forward on any type of, at least this year anyway, it's going to be tough to move forward on some type of cap and trade program or other firm limits on greenhouse gases.
The president also pitched this as something we have to do because of foreign competition. He's saying that other countries are sort of getting ahead of us here. How persuasive an argument do you think that is?
Well, I think certainly when the economy is so sour, that's formed one of the sort of main pillars of the White House argument. And, you know, that's frankly not all that distinct from what a lot of Republicans say on energy policy, too. There might be some differences, but I think what we've seen as a common theme is that the idea that energy policy is very much morphing into economic policy. You've got both the White House and again, many others saying, look, the United States has fallen behind many other countries on all sorts of, you know, quote-unquote clean energy technologies, be it solar panel manufacturing, which, you know, countries such as Germany have gone further on, or the wind industry. There's a real concern here that on these emerging energy technologies and the types of energy technologies that don't produce carbon dioxide emissions, that the United States has really sort of lost ground here to a lot of other competitors, mm-hmm. and that, you know, this type of increased federal support is really a way to not only sort of meet some of our kind of climate change and energy goals,
right.
but also a way to sort of kickstart some of these industries that could provide some manufacturing and construction jobs here.
Well, we're going to have to wrap it up there. Ben Geeman is with The Hill, the congressional newspaper. In a moment, the U.S. appears to have scored a major win in the fight against the Taliban. More on that coming up on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 10,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
I'm Cherry Glazer, back with To the Point. A man described as the Taliban's top military commander has reportedly been captured in Pakistan. The New York Times broke the story that Mullah Abdul Ghani Baradar was seized in a joint operation of U.S. and Pakistani forces. Joining us now is New York Times reporter Rod Nordlund, who's based in Kabul. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Who is Mullah Baradar? What do we know about the man?
Well, we know that he's after Mullah Omar, the leader of the Taliban, the most important of their commanders. He's thought to be very important in their financing and fundraising, and he's their military commander. And because of that position, he lives not in Afghanistan, but in Pakistan, which is where they rolled him up. Like most of the Taliban leaders, he's on that side of the border, not this one.
Is his capture primarily a psychological blow to the Taliban, or does it have strategic importance too, perhaps affecting their ability to mount military operations, or perhaps even is he able to provide information about other high-ranking leaders?
Well, certainly he would have a lot of information about the way they operate, where they're located, where the leaders are hiding. As to how much damage that will do to their military structure, I mean, it's a pretty diffuse organization, and certainly not immediately. There might be a long-term factor there. Maybe the biggest immediate result would be in the financing end, because he was thought to have been very key in their money-raising activities, particularly in smuggling opium and heroin.
What kind of intelligence is the U.S. hoping to get from him? Apparently, he's been undergoing interrogation by both Pakistani and U.S. sources. What are they hoping that Baradar can tell them?
Well, I guess the first question is, where's your boss? And, you know, that would be probably an even more important symbolic prize, although quite possibly Mullah Vardar is more important from a military standpoint than Mullah Omar, who's by all reports a little bit disengaged and more of a figurehead than an active war planner or executor.
Now, word of Mullah Vardar's capture comes just as the U.S., Afghan, and NATO forces have launched a new offensive against the Taliban in the town of Marja in southern Afghanistan. At this point, I'd like to bring in Greg Miller. He's national security correspondent. We understand that we have a little bit of a complication there. So, Mr. Nordland, can you provide a little bit of further information here? This is all happening as this offensive is just getting underway. Can you tell us what are the main goals of this offensive and how is it going?
Well, first of all, there's a part of me that doesn't like to believe in coincidences. And, you know, we have this coincidence that he was rolled up right in the middle of this operation. I mean, they have taken some Taliban low-level commanders in Marjan, and just possibly that information might have helped them. Although I think it's probably unlikely. I mean, they found him in Karachi, and as important as Marja is to the insurgents, it's unlikely that their local commanders there would have any specific intelligence about where he was. Plus, it would have been pretty quick processing of the information. You know, the Marja offensive is only 4 days old now.
We're now being joined by Greg Miller, national security correspondent for the LA Times. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Mr. Miller, Mr. Nordland was just talking about, you know, doesn't necessarily believe this is a coincidence that these two things have happened at once. How do you feel about the timing? Do you think this is key that we have this offensive at the same time that this high-ranking individual has been captured?
I don't know. I mean, that would be an interesting level of coordination if it were true that this were put together on at the same time on purpose. But I do think that this is the culmination of a series of factors, a collection of factors, including the extra troops and that the United States has sent, this operation that is underway, the repeated visits of U.S. officials to Pakistan to lean on the government to pursue figures like Brader, and the recent decision by the U.S. to provide Pakistan with drones, the recent strike against the leader of the Pakistan Taliban. I mean, the U.S. has done a lot to try to coax Pakistan along and prod them into doing something like this.
Does Mullah Vardar's capture in Pakistan have implications for the Taliban in Afghanistan?
Well, I mean, it's sure. I mean, it's big implications. I mean, he is regarded as the military mastermind of their operations in Afghanistan, and U.S. officials for some time have thought or suspected that there was, you know, some growing resentment among Taliban fighters in Afghanistan that their brave leaders were sending advice from over the border and not really in the fight.
Does this mean we now have two fronts in the fight against the Taliban, one in Afghanistan that is perhaps more militarily focused, with another in Pakistan that is perhaps more strategic, focusing on particular individuals?
I think there's been two fronts for quite a long time now, and I mean, this has been the difficulty of this conflict, because on one side of this border, the United States has a great deal of latitude to operate, and on the other, it's very limited and has had to use predator strikes and prodding the Pakistan government and intelligence service to carry out operations like this.
Greg Miller, national security correspondent for the LA Times. We've been talking with him. I'd like to bring Rod Nordland, staff writer for the New York Times, based in Kabul, back into the conversation. Mr. Nordland, do you think these two fronts, these two efforts in Afghanistan and Pakistan, are somehow complementary? If perhaps the U.S. and NATO forces were only taking on the Taliban in southern Afghanistan, would that provide the possibility for the Taliban to just move to other parts of the country, and that by tackling them in Pakistan, they're sort of trying to, you know, take them on two sides?
Well, I think it's maybe a little more nuanced than that. You have basically two different Talibans. You have the Taliban in Pakistan and Afghanistan, and although they have relations, they're very different beasts. And there's a long history in the past of Pakistan's intelligence services supporting the Taliban in Afghanistan. And what this may well indicate is that the Pakistanis have decided not to do that any longer and to cut those ties and to and to turn some of them over. And if that's the case, it could have really dire consequences for the Taliban leadership, who have depended on their sanctuaries in Pakistan. But I think, it's a little early to necessarily jump to that conclusion, but certainly very suggestive and could be a very positive development from the point of view of the Americans here in Afghanistan.
Mr. Nordland, we understand the U.S. assault on Marja is reportedly part of a shift in U.S. strategy in Afghanistan. I'd like to start out first with saying, what is different this time around?
Well, I mean, I think the most dramatic example of that is the incident on Sunday when 12 civilians or some number around 12 civilians were killed in a by an American rocket. The Americans very quickly took responsibility for that, launched an investigation, apologized. And if you compare that to a couple of years ago when we bombed weddings and killed people in the scores and even hundreds, and then denied any responsibility for it for a period of months. I mean, it just shows you the difference in their approach, and it's much more population-oriented, as they call it, much more sensitive to the issue of civilian casualties and trying to win people over.
The successful work on the part of both U.S. and Pakistani forces in capturing Mullah Baradar, does this indicate a closening of relations between U.S. and Pakistani intelligence agencies? Is this a sign that the U.S. has successfully enlisted Pakistan and publicly in this fight?
I don't know. I mean, I think that they've had, as much as they deny it, as the Pakistanis would deny it, they've had pretty warm relations. For political reasons, it's not something they can shout about from the rooftops. But if this indicates that the Pakistanis are willing to give up more, because there's always been a limit to their cooperation with the Americans, if they're willing to give up more and give up Taliban leaders in their sanctuaries, I mean, that really is an important development.
We've been talking with Rod Nordland, staff writer for the New York Times in Kabul. I'd like to touch base again briefly with Greg Miller of the L.A. Times. Mr. Miller, do you see this as a sign of Mullah Baradar's capture as a sign of increased cooperation between the U.S. and Pakistani intelligence forces? And how important is that?
Well, I mean, that's an obvious question, and I think it's to be determined. It certainly looks like it's a significant development in that cooperation that's been underway for some time now. And I think as your other guest was just pointing out, there has always been a limit to that cooperation. And maybe what we're seeing now is that the Pakistanis are moving that border, that boundary on their cooperation a little bit farther in the direction that the United States has been pushing them for some time now. And this is something that the United States has been all but saying that the Pakistanis could have done at any time they wanted over the past several years. And the question is, why did they choose to do this now?
That was Greg Miller, national security correspondent for the LA Times and co-author of the book The Interrogators, Inside the Secret War Against Al-Qaeda. At this point, I would like to bring in Brian Katulis, senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on.
Can you tell us, what do you think the capture of Baradar and the assault on the new assault in southern Afghanistan tells us at this point about the war on the Taliban, how the administration is approaching this?
Well, I would agree with the other guests who said it's still too early to tell. But for a long while, a lot of people here in Washington have talked about the Afghanistan-Pakistan challenge as a hammer and anvil approach, using more forces in Afghanistan as a hammer and against the insurgents and hoping that Pakistan would be the anvil. And there was a lot of concern about whether Pakistan would play that role. General McChrystal, our top commander in Afghanistan, put out a report last summer where he identified the three main Afghan insurgent groups and very directly said that the Pakistani security establishment supports the Afghan Taliban. And the fact that this arrest happened, I think, around the same time as the Marja operation, I think is purely coincidental, but it demonstrates that these issues are interlinked and that to achieve success in stabilizing Afghanistan, we need serious action in Pakistan. I happen to think it's still too early to tell whether the arrest of Baradar is significant enough, because there are other insurgent groups, the Haqqani Network, Gulbuddin Hekmatyar. All of these have been identified by U.S. officials as having support from Pakistan, and I think this arrest is significant, but I don't know if it's just one of many more to come or just one in isolation.
Mm-hmm. That's Brian Katulis, Senior Fellow at the Center for American Progress. Back to Rod Nordland, staff writer for The New York Times, who's reporting from Kabul. Mr. Nordland, on the ground there, what is the situation in Marja? What have the challenges been that the troops have had to deal with?
Well, they continue to have some sporadic small arms fire and sniping, and in some cases they're saying that that's intense. But for the most part, the tempo has been dying down, and their main concern is clearing what is an apparently enormous number of IEDs and hidden bombs. Just recently, they announced that an ISAF service member, we're not sure from what country yet, was killed today by an IED explosion in mm-hmm. Marja or in that area.
Mm-hmm. By and large, have they run into significant resistance from the Taliban? Does it appear that there are a significant number of Taliban forces still there?
No, it doesn't sound like there's huge numbers there. And the numbers, I think the estimates are that there may be a couple hundred left. That's a day ago, and maybe it's less now, or who knows. There are even some estimates that it's as little as 20 of them. It doesn't take that many snipers to cause a lot of difficulty, particularly when the terrain is littered with so many bombs that it's difficult for units to maneuver and to move around.
So at this point, the one of the major challenges the U.S. and coalition forces are facing are basically the IEDs or landmines, really.
That's right, and I think there's also a political concern too that the longer this goes on, and people are largely pinned down in their own houses, they can't get to their fields and farms and shops, and maybe sometimes it's difficult for them to even get basic supplies. I mean, that becomes an issue at some point. And General Nicholson, the U.S. Marine Corps commander, at one point said it may take as much as 30 days to clear out all these mines. Others have said it'll be over in a few more days. I doubt it'll be a few more days, at least in terms of clearing all this. But the tempo does seem to be going down day by day.
We've been talking about the latest developments in the U.S.'s new offensive in southern Afghanistan, coming at a time when news media are just reporting the capture of a major military Taliban leader in Pakistan. We'll continue this conversation after a brief break, plus a bombshell in the world of figure skating. We'll be back in a minute with To the Point from PRI.
A complete archive of past programs is available online at kcrw.com/to the point. You can also order a CD copy by calling 1-888-600-5279.
I'm Cherry Glazer, sitting in for Warren Olney today on To the Point. Media outlets have been buzzing with the news that the Taliban's top military leader, Mullah Abdul Ghani Baradar, has been captured in Pakistan. This comes just as the U.S., Afghan, and NATO troops have launched a new offensive in southern Afghanistan. Brian Katulis is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and co-author of the book The Prosperity Agenda, What the World Wants from America and What We Need in Return. Mr. Katulis, the U.S. is providing significant military muscle in this offensive, but this assault also depends heavily on Afghan forces and ultimately the Afghan government. What are they being called on to do, and are they up to the job?
Well, I think at this stage, they are assisting in some of the clearing operations. The real test of this operation in Marja will come in the weeks and months and maybe even years after this, whether the Afghan security forces and then Afghan institutions can actually hold this area and then provide functioning governance, which is, I think, the centerpiece of the struggle. U.S. commanders have put this front and center as a major challenge, making sure that the institutions of Afghan government provide justice and for the basic needs of their citizens. And that, quite frankly, has been the fundamental challenge. General McChrystal, over the weekend, talked about having a government in a box.
Yes, right.
That
sort of sounds like an Erector set or something.
Yeah, I mean, we here in Washington would love to have a government in a box that actually did health care and the economic stimulus. All of this, I think, is the right instinct because it does identify, I think, a fundamental challenge and problem that the Afghan citizens have with their government, which has been seen as corrupt and not providing. It's all easier said than done, and it's a big challenge. But this government in a box includes, you know, international components. There's a civilian surge that is going hand in glove with the additional troops that have been placed on the ground. But building institutions and dealing with the local politics and local power struggles is all very easier said than done and easy to map out on paper, but harder to actually do in practice, as we've seen over the past few years in Afghanistan and, quite frankly, as we're seeing in Iraq to this day.
Complicating the situation, I mean, do the people in Marja trust the central government to look out for their best interest, to provide for them in these kinds of ways?
I actually don't know. I've not visited Marja myself. I was out in Afghanistan for the elections last year, the presidential elections, which had many flaws and many problems and actually had very low voter turnout. So I would presume that there's a high degree of skepticism about the effectiveness of the central government. And I think that's the fundamental test over the medium to long term. I think it's hard for Americans to understand that ultimately in these types of fights, we're going to have to depend on others to step up, and in this case, the others being Afghan governing officials at all levels, to provide. And we can train, we can give taxpayer money, we can give equipment and arming, but ultimately it comes down to motivation and whether these leaders are willing to deal with a lot of the challenges that exist in their country.
We've been talking with Brian Katulis, Senior Fellow at the Center for American Progress. I'd now like to bring in journalist Gretchen Peters. She covered Afghanistan and Pakistan for more than 10 years for the Associated Press and ABC. She's also author of the book Seeds of Terror, How Heroin is Bankrolling the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. Ms. Peters, are Afghan troops and the Afghan government up to the role that has been sketched out for them in this new offensive?
Well, that's the great debate between proponents of counterinsurgency theory and those who suggest that stabilizing Afghanistan is not something remotely within the capacity of NATO and Afghan troops to achieve. That's the million-dollar question that everyone is waiting to see.
Now, it's not like this isn't complicated enough to try and deal with the Taliban and then also basically build a government or public services from the ground up, as Mr. Katulis was describing, you know, what's being called a government in a box. There are some challenges that are particular to the Marja region as well. For starters, this is a center of heroin production, right?
Yes, Marja is a major heroin-producing town. Last year, there was a brief offensive into the town by NATO and Afghan forces, and they managed to capture within a Taliban compound that had a sophisticated communications center and a storage depot for explosives and suicide vests. They also managed to find 91 tons of hashish, heroin, opium, poppy seeds, and precursor chemicals. This was the second largest drug seizure in global history. So we're talking about an area that's a major economic driver for the Taliban and the drug traffickers with whom they collaborate. And so cutting that off is at least going to slow down their business for a little while. Probably won't put them out of business. There are already indications that some of the labs that operated there have shifted, but it's certainly going to make it more difficult for the Taliban to operate in that regard.
So in trying to, you know, address the issues of dealing with the Taliban, but also wiping out the poppy fields, you're basically talking about trying to lay the groundwork for a new governmental system, a new economy. How long might this take to get the locals to switch away from poppy cultivation to grow legal crops and to try and lay a firm groundwork for that?
Well, I can tell you one thing, which is that it's not going to be done in 18 months. the limit that, that President Obama appears to have put on at least major U.S. operations there. If you look at other countries like Turkey and Thailand that have eradicated or that were major drug producers and now are not, it really took about a decade to effectively get rid of a drug economy. And those were drug economies that were much smaller than the one that currently exists in Afghanistan and that were a much smaller portion of those countries' GDP. No country in the world has ever had drugs make up as great a percentage of its GDP as Afghanistan does. By some accounts, at one point, drugs made up 50% of Afghanistan's gross national product. Now it's probably more around 30 or 40%. But if you compare, it never reached much more than 15 or 20% of Colombia's GDP. So this is really going to be a major project, both to interdict the major drug traffickers, to disrupt the funds and money laundered funds that are coming back into their coffers, and also supporting the Taliban and corrupt officials, to clean up the problem of corruption, and to move farmers and other people who work in the drug trade onto alternative livelihoods. These are long-term projects. They're very difficult, and unfortunately, there's no real silver bullet in terms of making it go more quickly. There are a lot of suggestions out there that we should just buy the crop, or we could eradicate all the fields using aerial spraying. None of those things are going to get rid of the fundamental structural problems that are behind all of this.
We've been talking with journalist Gretchen Peters, who covered Afghanistan and Pakistan for both the Associated Press and ABC News. Brian Katulis, senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, you've just heard Ms. Peters saying this is not exactly what you would call a quick turnaround project trying to wean the people of Marja away from poppy cultivation, that this is going to be a long-term issue. Is the U.S. really in this for the long haul?
Well, that remains to be seen. And, you know, anyone, everybody who's listening should read Gretchen's great book, The Seeds of Terror, which talks about how dangerous the poppy crop is and how it feeds an insurgency. I think this administration, the Obama administration, was quite clear in that it was sending military forces for a focused period of time, but that the longer term, the United States needs to stay there to help with the Afghan citizens with these sorts of problems. How that works out in detail in 2011, 2012, and beyond, I think remains to be seen. And it's very much not only a policy issue in terms of how things develop on the ground, but it's a political issue here back home. And quite frankly, I think many Americans have a certain limit on their patience and the amount of money we want to spend overseas. And I think President Obama is trying to balance all of that in his statements. So I think there's an interest in staying there, particularly in providing the support and building institutions and playing a support function to the nascent Afghan institutions. And there's an understanding that this is going to take a lot longer than just 18 months. And I think, you know, part of the issue is we'll cross that bridge in 2011, 2012, and assess what the situation is on the ground at that time.
Mr. Katulis, what, you know, going into this kind of offensive, usually in military strategies, there's a definition of, you know, this is what we're going to do, this is what we need to accomplish. What is the definition of success here? Do we know?
Well, that's a very good question. It's one I've asked. If you look at the administration's latest regional stabilization plan, it's a document they put out in late January. I did an assessment of that. It's available on our website, AmericanProgress.org. There's still a lot of gaps, and people on Ambassador Holbrooke's team and people, my friends in the White House, acknowledge that it's very much a work in progress. But the fundamental question of how do we define success, I think still remains a very open-ended question. There's an effect that we want to achieve from U.S. policy, and President Obama has been very clear. He wants to deter al-Qaeda in Afghanistan and Pakistan. What that actually means on the ground, if you look at this administration document, is still very unclear. And I think it's perhaps a little unfair to say, well, they need to have great clarity about where we're going to be in 2012 or 2015. But you look at the document on where a year into this administration, we still don't have the idea of what a defined end state looks like. This stabilization document, I think, focuses on decentralized governance, which is very important. But if you look at President Hamid Karzai, the president of Afghanistan's speech at the London conference at the end of January, he has a different take on that matter. So we're still very much in this "we'll know it when we see it" assessment phase on Afghanistan, and maybe that's the best that we can do. I think we could do a little bit better, and hopefully as we get more people on the ground, we'll have a greater clarity to the answer to that question.
We've been talking with Brian Katula, Senior Fellow at the Center for American Progress. Gretchen Peters is a reporter who has covered Afghanistan and Pakistan for the Associated Press and ABC News. Ms. Peters, my understanding is that part of the strategy of this offensive is also economic, to offer jobs to Taliban insurgents to try and woo them away, help them make the transition to civilian life. What are the odds that this might be successful?
Well, there are various types of Taliban. I don't think anybody among the American military or NATO military commanders in Afghanistan thinks that the hardcore Taliban officials at the level of Mullah Baradar are going to be co-opted and convinced to take a job working on an American aid project instead of fighting with the Taliban. But there are a lot of lower rank fighters with the Taliban and the other factions of the insurgency in Afghanistan who in many cases appear to just pick up weapons because of other grievances they have or simply because they're paid to. And so the idea is that through a combination of delivering some support to them in terms of reducing those political and ethnic grievances they might have and also offering them alternative jobs and the opportunity to live within a safe conflict-free zone will succeed in pulling people away. Well, one thing that has become very clear to me in the research that I've done, and I'm just completing another big paper in conjunction with West Point's Combating Terrorism Center on this issue, is that Afghans and Pakistanis are exhausted by the level of criminality that exists on both sides of the border. It's not just the drug trade. It's that's a major factor in the south in areas like Marja, but it's the kidnapping, the extortion, bribery, other types of smuggling. People's lives are chewed up by this, and while they may make more money right now engaging in criminal activities like the drug trade, at the end of the day, they really don't earn that much in the current environment because it is so exploitative.
We were talking earlier about the role that Afghanistan has been outlined for both Afghan forces and the Afghan government to play. Specifically, what kind of a partner does the U.S. have in Afghan President Hamid Karzai? What is his role here, and does he look to be willing to fulfill it?
Well, he seems to be a fairly unreliable partner at the moment. I do think that the U.S. could have more leverage over him and probably needs to work to improve relations with him at the diplomatic level. However, particularly with regards to corruption in the drug trade, there are widespread allegations that members of his administration, even members of his own family, are deeply involved in protecting the drug trade. And he has not only made no effort to investigate those claims, much less to remove those people, he has actually gone and pardoned a number of officials who were convicted by Afghan courts of involvement in the drug trade and other corruption. So that is a very, very difficult aspect of this entire project is the counterinsurgency, most experts will tell you, is only as good as the government that it supports. And with a tremendously low level of legitimacy, the Karzai government presents certain problems. Again, within the counterinsurgency doctrine, you'll hear people say that if the local government does something tolerably well, that's still better than foreign forces doing it extremely well. But So in that regard, the Karzai government doesn't have a very high bar to hit, because the Taliban, the Taliban's form of government is often seen as so brutal in the rural areas. Mm-hmm.
Brian Katulis with the Center for American Progress. It seems like, you know, there are strategies for attacking the Taliban, trying to woo low-level insurgents away from the Taliban. Should we be talking directly to the Taliban? And if so, does the capture of this high-ranking military official, Mullah Bardar, make that any easier?
Well, I think at this conference in London I mentioned that took place last month, there was, I think, fairly broad support for reintegration efforts of former Taliban. And I think that's mostly focused at the lower level fighters who may have been looking for a job, the so-called accidental insurgent. And I think there's, the U.S. has been pretty clear in terms of its policy, and it restated it quite well in London. It said that, you know, we would go along with any reconciliation of any higher-level Taliban insurgent on three conditions. One, that they cease with the violence. Two, they cut ties with al-Qaeda. And then three, that they recognize the Afghan constitution and the legitimacy of the government there. So I think that's part of the strategy here, and quite frankly, what we're trying to do in applying military force is to change the strategic calculations of some of these Taliban insurgents. And part of a successful strategy that stabilizes the country will involve co-opting some of these people back into the governance structure. Mm-hmm. That raises bigger questions about moral values and, you know, these sorts of people and what type of law they stand for, whether they respect the sorts of rights that we're in favor of. But from the strategy standpoint, as I see it right now, those are of lesser concern, and the U.S. is very concerned about helping bring stability both to Afghanistan and Pakistan.
We've been talking with Brian Katulis, senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, journalist Gretchen Peters, author of Seeds of Terror, How Heroin is Bankrolling the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, Greg Miller, national security correspondent for the LA Times, and Rod Nordland, staff writer for the New York Times based in Kabul. Thank you all. It's the end of an era. Last night, Chinese teams won both gold and silver in pairs figure skating at the Winter Olympics in Vancouver. It's the first time in almost 50 years that Russia or the Soviet Union did not walk off with a gold medal. More on that coming up on To the Point from PRI.
For more information about To the Point or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/to the point.
I'm Cherry Glazer, sitting in for Warren Ollie, back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. A major change in the athletic world order. Almost 50 years of Russian domination in pairs figure skating ended last night when Chinese teams swept both the gold and silver medals at the Winter Olympics. American figure skater Paul Wiley, who won the silver medal in the men's competition in 1992, was ringside in Vancouver for the competition. It's a real privilege to have you here, Mr. Wiley. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you. It's a beautiful day here in Vancouver.
Glad to hear it. It sounds like the Chinese really nailed it.
Well, actually, they didn't skate their best, but they were able to edge out their countryman Peng Yitong at Shenan Chow, who won the gold. They had one mistake in the program. They let down a lift, and luckily for them, they let down the lift after two rotations, and so they were able to get credit for the lift with minus two on the grades of execution. Otherwise, I think they would have missed the gold.
Now, this, of course, is, you know, we were mentioning earlier, is a huge change as far as sort of, you know, years, decades of tradition in figure skating. How did the Russians do? What happened that they weren't able to sort of perpetuate that dynasty?
Well, Kabaguti and Smirnov, they were supposed to, they had a plan to throw quad Saukow, which they turned into a triple, and then they made some other mistakes on side-by-side jumps, and then the other team, Mahortova and Trankov, botched both their side-by-side jumps in the short program and in the free skate. So, you know, they just were not up to what the Chinese pairs were offering. And, you know, this is not an overnight sensation. The Chinese have won between the two of these pairs four world championships between Peng Yitong and Shenan Zhao. And, you know, they've been Olympic favorites before. In fact, in 2006, They were favorites going into that whole year, and then Hong Bo-Xiao basically ruptured his Achilles tendon in November, and then came back from that injury to miraculously win a bronze medal there. So this was the only thing that they lacked in their career. I mean, they had retired and then came back to this event. And I think there was much anticipation in their return, because what they have gained over the 17 years together is just a tremendous amount of poise and confidence, but speed and explosive power as well.
Do you think that this loss, or I mean, the Russians did come in third, but, you know, the loss of the gold, is this an end of an era for Russia?
The Russians came in fourth, actually.
I beg your pardon,
yes. The Germans were in third. Right. It is the end of an era. I mean, for as long as we can remember, as long as I have been living, actually, since the Protopopovs in 1964 and 68, the Russians have had a gold medalist in the Olympic Games. And you know, I think that they take and took a lot of pride in that string of victories, and I think that there was a system, and there, you know, to even sweep the medals in an Olympics in one case, and so there's a sense, I think, now of okay, there will never be that kind of a dynasty in the sport, because of the international judging system and the way that there's just the ability to sort of look into a performance more deeply than just two numbers, the technical and the artistic mark.
Now, you were talking about the scoring system. This came in actually 8 years ago after the Salt Lake Games, but it sort of has been a source of controversy ever since. How is this new system different? What's the big deal?
Well, judging is always controversial, you know, because it involves people. So there's no clock that, if we didn't have people judging, we wouldn't have a sport. So that's where you begin, because there are opinions, and our sport takes the artistry and what we call the program components very seriously. In fact, the system is designed to make basically 50% of the score rely on skating skills, transitions, interpretation, performance and execution, and choreography. And those are very important when you look at that. I do believe, because in the old system, there were two marks. There was, and remember, the 6.0 was perfect, and everything was a deduction off of that. Mm-hmm. And with those two marks, and the technical and artistic, it seemed like the judges were always trying to figure out how not to tie the top performers. And this system is much more, it's based on each element. So each element is called by a technical specialist, a former skater, and then ratified by a judge so that the judges aren't worried about what they're seeing. The technical specialist and the technical panel is deciding what they're seeing, and then the judges are giving it a grade of execution, sort of giving the impression of what that, and they have certain bullet points that they have to adhere to, so there are guidelines and accountability for that. And then they are responsible for the five component marks that I mentioned earlier. So, yes, I believe that judging will continue to be controversial, because everyone has favorites and opinions, and those aren't always the same. However, I have had fewer quibbles with the results of the competition since the international judging system has sort of gained, cruising altitude, if you will, over the past 3 years.
Now, very quickly, the men's short program goes today with the men's free skate on Thursday. A lot of talk about American Johnny Weir. He's not expected to medal, but is quite a character. Who are you going to be watching? Him? Somebody else?
Well, I think that Johnny knows how to grab the headlines, but Evan Lysacek is the has been amazing in practice. I am mentoring Jeremy Abbott, so I'm very much involved with his story and hoping that he skates his best. I think the world is looking at the return of Evgeny Plushenko, and he has a very strong program plan with quad triple combination. Also with a quad combination would be Stefan Lambiel, but he has a weakness because he doesn't have the triple axel. The Canadian favorite Patrick Chan doesn't have a quad, but is an amazing stylist and has phenomenal footwork. So really, it's kind of, there's about eight guys who are shooting for the top three spots with strengths and weaknesses, and it should be very entertaining. And I think Johnny, you know, he's the kind of guy that does grab the headlines, and I mean, he's going to have to put his performances out there. He's marked all of his practices where he hasn't really gone through his program, so he's a big question mark in my mind.
American figure skater Paul Wiley won the men's silver medal at the 1992 Olympics and is covering this year's Winter Games in Vancouver. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Today's program was produced by Gary Scott with Katie Cooper and Sonia Geis. The technical director is Mike Newport. The managing producer is Karen Radsner. I'm Cherry Glazer, sitting in for Warren Olney. Join us again for To The Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
Public Radio International.